Ready? Who wrote Tetrabodha? I'm not sure. It might be one of the Shankaracharyas. I don't think it was Shankara. I think even if it's attributed to him, it's not his. Maybe he doesn't write like that, as Swamiji would say. But you know, there's a lot of the things. I mean, I actually don't know who wrote it, but I've heard some people say Shankara. I doubt it. If it's Shankara, it would be one of the Shankaracharyas. Where does it come from? I don't know. What does Tetrabodha mean? Knowledge of truth. Tetrabodha is knowledge. Tetrabodha is knowledge, and Tetra is the truth, or the essence of all things. Tet is a pronoun, means that. So a pronoun will land on anything. So the essence, the ness of that, the reality of all things is Tetra. Just the reality, we say. I don't know how Swamiji found that book, or somebody taught it to him, or if he came across it like some other books he's come across, like a famous one, it's Advaita Makaranda. Really beautiful. We've taught it. I think I may have taught it in Mangalam, I'm not sure. Yeah. Beautiful text. And he just came across it at a bookstore, an old bookstore. And when he started reading it, whoa. When we talk to the inner child, is it from the self? Okay, that's a good question. They're all good questions, but interesting things to say about it. The Atma, the self, first of all, doesn't talk, right? So it doesn't have a voice or ears or limbs. It's just pure conscious being, that Shuddha Chaitanya, just pure consciousness, doesn't do anything. That's why it's beyond time and space, and so it actually can't do anything. You can't be beyond time and space and any type of objectivity and be able to do something. So you just, the Atma just simply is me as pure consciousness. But now, when we do this inner child work, the first thing to understand with that is that you need to be a good enough mother or father, the one who's, or person, or guru, or whatever, the one who's actually talking to those little ones. So you don't want to talk to them in the way that you were talked to when you were little, that caused you so much pain and trauma. And so they need to feel safe. You know, they need to feel loved. They need to feel welcomed. They need to feel that there's only that you just love them and you want to help them and you respect them. So that critical voice isn't there at all. And so then they can trust you, you know. So now when you think of all of those kind of adjectives, like being, you know, trustworthy and welcoming and loving and caring and all these, those really are kind of verbal forms of your own nature, right? Being somebody that doesn't evoke any fear whatsoever, abhayam, that's the nature of the self. The self by its nature is not doing any welcoming, but its nature is welcoming. You know, there's nothing rejecting in your own nature, you know, or critical. There's no critical person there. There's just that, how can I help without the words? Just peace, deep, deep peace without a hint of fear or rejection. And so when the buddhi, when your buddhi can rest in yourself, and as opposed to resting in an agitation or a critical mind or emotion or something that's going on in the manas, then that buddhi, that's the good enough mother. The one that can go and be with the little ones inside, you know, because they won't be afraid of you. And just think of growing up, you know, depending on the type of parents you had. Like some people had parents that the children couldn't wait for them to come home and just jump into their arms and be so happy they're home. And there are other children that when they saw the parents or the father coming home, would run and hide. There was nothing, no feeling of safety at all. You know, and so especially those children, need to kind of recreate. We need to re-raise ourselves in a way to the degree that we were traumatized growing up. So everybody has kind of a different story. I mean, nobody had a perfect upbringing, and no parents can be perfect. That's why we say good enough. No parents can be perfect and second-guess their child's needs every moment. But that love is there, and that wanting to help is there, and that adoration of who they just are as a little being. So we need to be able to give that to the little ones inside so that they can talk to us and tell us all about it and know that they're special and feel loved, and then they can start growing up again. They've been frozen in that state. So when we talk about the good enough mother or the inner friend, that means that buddhi is really an expression of yourself. It's like instead of being, you know, resolved into anger, it's resolved into your own nature. And your own nature is beloved to all beings. So be beloved to you and to the little ones also. Wow, this is the second time? What is that? That happened this morning. This thing has some messages for me. I'm going to do something about this right now. Yeah. Then it turns this thing off too. So. Okay. Does that make sense? That's what it is. Please tell us about Samadhi Dasha Sampanna again and unfold it a bit more. Okay, this Samadhi Dasha, this place of Samadhi, the one who is Sampanna, who has gained that. So let's look at it just in terms of the buddhi, okay? So the buddhi usually is directed outward. It's commenting on whatever is going on in the manas, whatever type of vrittis you're having, perceptions you're having, or what your thoughts, all of this, the ahankara. It's commenting and focused on that. And consciousness, which is this very being, is illumining the focus of the buddhi, whatever that may be. But the focus is upon normally and very naturally things that are objectifiable. Like, say, for instance, your emotions are objectifiable. So when we do inner child work, or say walking along and you're feeling very, very hurt, you know you're feeling hurt. There's a subject-object relationship there, and the buddhi can come into relationship with that. You know, or you're getting to directions to go into town, and so you have to pay attention and figure that out. And then you execute that. Right, so the buddhi is focused on a project. As opposed to the buddhi, instead of being used to negotiate and make decisions and gain knowledge, or on this external world, the internal, external, anything external to itself, which would be the manas and the sense organs, the body and the whole world, all of this can be objectified. And so instead of being engaged with these objectifications, which are many and varied, instead, the buddhi is recognizing or gently focusing on its own being, on the me. And when it does that, you know, in a way, turning its direction more inward means to that innermost self as opposed to outward. So it's just recognizing its own being. That's the Samadhi Dasha. So now, when that is happening, now from the standpoint of the buddhi, what is filling that, when the buddhi turns away from things that you can objectify, what is filling that is just me, conscious being. It's not, there's no objectification at all. In fact, the buddhi is turning toward the consciousness which objectifies the buddhi. So there is no, then there, the buddhi is, the consciousness is what illumines the buddhi, and which is now, because of the buddhi focusing on that, is the object of the buddhi, you know. And so what happens is, at that time, all of the different nama rupas and different engagements that are external are not of interest to the buddhi. The buddhi is not focusing on it, just on the self. So that dasha, that's the place of samadhi, where the mind is, where the buddhi is resolved into the self. There's no subject-object relationship there. There's just Shuddha Chaitanya, just me. In the sense that the buddhi is focused on and resting in me, as opposed to all the myriad of other vrittis it could be having. So now, normally, the same me is there illumining all of the variety of objectifiable vrittis, thought modifications. There's many, many, many. The self is just quiet, stays there as conscious being, the adhishtana of all of those vrittis. But the interest of the mind or the buddhi is on the content of the vrittis, which are other than myself. They're mithya content. The self is still very much there as the adhishtana of the buddhi and of the content. But what about when the buddhi, instead of being engaged in these externalized objectifications, the buddhi is just turning toward its own being? And then what is the dominant experience there from the standpoint of the buddhi is just me, conscious being, no subject-object relationship. Because there's can't be any objectification of the self, so the buddhi really just becomes quiet and resolves into the self, which is the one who's illumining it, right? So that's how, if I really answered this or not, that's how that works. So if you say samadhi dasha is like the place where that samadhi is happening. Sampanna means the one who has gained that, has recognized it. Now, another little thing about that is, say, when the teaching is taking place and the pramana is taking place and something is being explained, say, for instance, it's going to happen in meditation too, because the meditations are guided. There are words kind of coming at you, and at different points along the way, those words resolve into what they're pointing at. So say there are words that are kind of taking you to the recognition of just you, just me, this conscious being that I am. And you see that. So the words resolve into the fact of it. That's that samadhi dasha. At that time, one has recognized the self, directed by the pramana, which is really takes place through words. So they're kind of taking you step by step by step to that recognition, and you gain a glimpse. Glimpse. They're not really glimpses. They're actually knowledge, because each time that happens, you see it. Doesn't matter how long it, if you see it for a long time or short time, doesn't make any difference. The self has no time. You've differentiated it. That's the main thing. And so the teaching, while teaching is taking place, the hope is that is happening. Those moments of recognition are happening. And that's how the pramana works. Now, when we do guided meditation, the same thing, except that we're kind of in a meditative state, trying to direct the mind. If you're following the meditation, it's kind of directing the mind to recognizing something that is there. That reminds me of another thing I wanted to mention about these guided meditations. So once in a while we won't have it; I'll just sit there quietly. But when we do have one, sometimes you'll find your mind doing the one, whatever I'm doing, you'll be doing that one. Sometimes you won't be, and that is fine. Sometimes your mind wants to do something else, and then my voice just becomes more or less soothing background noise. That used to happen to me with Swamiji, but I always loved his voice and it created like a nice space for me, but my mind was doing something else. And so I always go with what it's doing. I trust that. You can follow the meditation. There's something to be gained from it. But if you're onto your own thing, there's something to be gained from that too. So I didn't want you to worry about that if you do it, because we all do. there's value in it too. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad thing. I feel a strong resistance to take another body after this life. I want to become a jnani in this life. I wonder how I can work with that resistance, since that is a dvesha and a binding dislike, you can say. I think the resistance to live another life is due to fear of suffering, and that I'm sick of becoming disease. Well, I wouldn't worry about it. I would just spend your time gaining knowledge. This isn't the type of thing where you're supposed to study for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. In the tradition, it's once you get here to this knowledge, then you gain this knowledge, and there's no coming back, unless there's some kind of prarabdha, sometimes some prarabdha, some karma in you that needs more than one life to exhaust itself, and then you'll want to finish that. They talk about it in the Brahma Sutras a little bit, but you don't want to come back because you don't want the dukkha, you know. But the fact is also, once you gain knowledge, then yourself never has dukkha. Your mind might, your body might, the world might, but yourself will never have dukkha, because it never has had dukkha. It can't have dukkha. You are what you are, and your being is absolutely free. The mind, because of the prarabdha karma, and the body, because of the prarabdha karma, can have funny vrittis, painful situations. But even then, for a jnani, you learn to have a certain vairagya toward the painful situations also. There's no need to push them away. This loka has a lot of painful situations in it, if that's how you're responding to it. You could say, I'd like things to be different, but they're not different. Not everything is not Swargaloka, so there are some situations that are really difficult and hard and challenging. But if you're objective, Swamiji uses often the word objective. You have to be objective. You know, what is the best way for me to handle this situation? How can I help? You know, because the more you know yourself, the less you want to get involved in situations in a negative way, where you are reacting or getting angry or all huffy and all of this. It's not worth it. There's no reason. There is no ananda other than you. You are the ananda, you know. And your mind is never, ever, and can never be away from that source of ananda. And so just because of habit, the mind gets pulled out into the world as though you're an ajnani, even though you know of the whole thing that's happening still, just habitually it'll get pulled out in this way and that way. And more you realize, no, I'm not gonna go there. And you just bring your mind home, you know, we're not gonna go that way. Because there's no reason to, really. And to the degree that you externalize your pleasure, you know, like I need it to be, that, you know, we talked in Mangalam last time about the binding and non-binding desires. You'll always have desires as long as you're living, because you have to move, you have to do things. You can't do things if you don't have any desire to do them. And so desires are not going to go away, but what does go away is their binding nature. Like, if I don't get my way, I'm going to be really angry or really upset. We don't want that. It's not necessary. Those ways of behaving drop off. It's not the desire doesn't drop off, but the binding nature drops off, because they're not worth it. To just get your mind all riled up and upset and worried about this and worried about that. Why? when the ananda, that when what you're seeking, the wholeness that you're seeking, is your own being, you're just going in the opposite direction. So you'll find yourself, this is what probably, because I think we all kind of operate in the same way, in a way. You'll get to a place where these negative reactions and getting all miffed about this and that, your mind just doesn't want to do that. Even though it's not an optimal situation, you still don't have to get involved in it that way. It's not worth it because the shanti is so wonderful. Yourself is so whole and complete in the shanti. Why mess up with your mind up like that? You just don't want to do it. And so you find yourself giving these things up and then being in the situation in an objective, helpful way. Because that's dharma, and that keeps your shanti. You feel good about you, yourself, and the ananda is not thwarted or, you know, covered. So you just have to enjoy your own growth, your own maturity, and kind of take pleasure in your mind deciding it's not going to get upset about this or that. When it takes a little move to do it, you just say, I don't think so. It's such a pleasure, you know. I'm not going to go there. And then to have that shama, where you have a choice to let those big reactions go and to just be present and handle objectively the situation you find yourself in. And you feel really good about that because there's some control. And it's the control that you have is really based upon your knowing the source of ananda is your own being and doesn't exist out there. Otherwise, we would be at such a mess. Like the world is. You think your ananda, what you need to be happy, to be whole, is out there. And so does this person, so does that person. It becomes a mayhem, you know. But what if when you know that it's not, then you can just be in your the prarabdha karma and kind of enjoy it. Because this is another big difference between having knowledge and not having knowledge. When you don't have knowledge, you continue to look for happiness except for the little 15-second samadhis we're given. We're still looking, always looking to make a better situation for ourselves. And so you can't really enjoy your life, the life you have, because we're working to improve and get that happy, you know, space where I've achieved what is to be achieved. That's what we're doing. We're trying to achieve what is to be achieved so I can be a whole, happy, successful person. But ajnani, that's all gone. Now it's just enjoying the prarabdha karma, bhagavan. The prarabdha karma is bhagavan. And this is your life, you know, and you don't need it to be any different to be happy, so you can actually be present. You can also, you can love your partner, you can love your children, you can love all your relatives, the people that you work with, because you don't need them to be different so that you can be happy. Otherwise, we need everybody to be this way or that way, you know, so that we can have the shanti. We need them to act in certain ways to give us shantavrittis. Really? That's why in the first portion of the Vedas, dharma is so important. Because dharma gives shanti. And so if I follow dharma, if other people follow dharma, that's nice. But if I follow dharma, as an ajnani or ajnani, I have shanti. Because that level of dharma is underneath and deeper than the raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes and thwarted desires. It doesn't really matter to me if you're a dharmanishta, somebody whose commitment is to dharma. Then the mind is in harmony with Ishvara. That karma yoga buddhi is kind of natural. And the mind enjoys relative shanti. The only thing beyond that is the absolute shanti of the self. And so that for the dharmanishta and the jnani are close. Because the dharmanishta, the one who's rooted in dharma, where dharma is their value of values, is dharma. They've assimilated that. So they're committed to that. So they have a high degree of ongoing shanti, even though relative. And so that, and that Ishvara Arpanam Buddhi, seeing everything as Ishvara, he gives a relative shanti. But for the jnani, the shanti is not relative. It's changeless. It's absolute. It's the nature of the self. You know? And the mind that knows that revels in that fact. And if it does something else, that it's okay, you just pull it back. Poor thing, it's lost its way for the moment. Okay. And it's all good. It's nice to gain knowledge and mature into your knowledge. So you gain the knowledge, but then you keep realizing on deeper and deeper levels, and it makes the life very beautiful, you know, because you won't go backwards. You can't become a mumukshu and then decide you're not one. Mm-hmm. It's too late. You have to go all the way there. It says that in chapter 7 of Panchadashi, the teacher tells the students, you can't go back, sorry. Too late. You came to this recognition and there's no way to get rid of it. You can't get rid of your knowledge. Where do the different lokas exist? Do they have a location? Since we say there are 7 lokas up and 7 down, it can seem like this is similar to heaven and hell in Christianity. Yeah, the up and down are similar, and the up are different levels of subtlety that are bring more sukha, more joy, and down are different levels of dukkha. The difference between Christianity and the Vedas is Christianity is a permanent heaven or hell. It's only one life, one heaven, one hell, wherever you end up going, or purgatory for Catholics. But in the Vedanta, or in this Vedic vision, these lokas are experiences kind of earned by your punya and papa, that then you pay a price, you have to pay for it. For those pleasurable experiences with a lot of your punya. Your punya gets exhausted. Your papa gets exhausted too. And then you come back. So that's different. But now, in terms of where they are located, we don't really know, because this is Shastric. It's not like we've ever been there. We take it with some Shraddha from the first portion of the Vedas, that these lokas and the, and also the whole culture, like the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Puranas, the, all of them accept all of this and describe them in different ways, you know. But it's not something that that we've gone and looked to see what they're really like or where they are. But say you would think about them, maybe perhaps in terms of orders of subtlety, you know, not of this, like this is the Bhuloka. It's not necessarily that high up in the highest heaven of this particular loka, there's a heaven loka in this same realm. I think we have to probably look at it in terms of levels of subtlety, where everything can be coexisting in the same time and place, but they're in totally different dimensions like that.
What is subtlety?
Subtle.
Okay.
Yeah, more and more subtle. But I don't know, there may be more detailed descriptions probably in some of the texts they have, but we don't bother too much about it. We just take it on Shraddha that those are there. But it's not really what we're interested in or the subject matter of the Vedanta. It's just kind of when we're talking about the structure of the creation, that's going to come in the different heaven levels and hell levels and all of that type of thing. Not going into any detail at all, really. In Taittiriya Upanishad, they say a little bit, just like half a sentence about each level. So, and talks about it in terms of levels of subtlety. So there's probably more on it. There's a lot to learn, a lot to read, if you want to get into, especially the Karmakanda and the nature of the cosmos and how it's all structured and everything, how reincarnation works, how the different kinds of karma work. A lot of different things to learn. The Shastra says that a jnani doesn't take a new body, transmigrate, when he or she dies. K. Can you explain why and how it works? Is it because there are no binding desires left that needs to be exhausted? Does the Sukshma Sharira die then? I'll probably get into this in some detail, so I'll just do it a little bit quickly now because we can't really have time to do a whole unfoldment on it. So I'll just kind of tell you what the Shastra says. When a person has self-knowledge, there is no longer self-ignorance. Right? And so what that means is that the buddhi or the sukshma sharira is not really looking anymore. If you have that jnana nishtha, you know, clarity, your buddhi, your mind, so the subtle body, is not really interested in trying to get sukha here, or I want another life so I can play tennis. I used to want that. I'm such a terrible tennis player, and I really thought, well, I need another life to be able to play it well. So those kind of things drop off. Those desires, you know, they say, oh, I'd like to do this, and I'd like to have an opportunity to do this. And that's, so I'd like to go to Satyaloka and see how that is, and, you know, take a birth where I can do this and that. You know, so those are kind of off fantasies of people kind of within the Vedic culture, you know, because they know that they have another life and many, many other lives. And when they're not able to do something well in this life, they'll say something like, well, let me really work on it this life and then I can master it in the next life. You know, I hope that my samskaras will pull me into the next life and then I could gain that mastery. So they're not crunched into this one little tiny life where so many of your desires have no opportunity of being fulfilled. So there that you have every opportunity. You know, you have lifetimes to accomplish everything you would love to do. But once you get to this stage of having knowledge, then you actually accomplish everything that you've ever wanted from all of these things that you thought you wanted. You wanted all of these things so that you could be a whole and complete and full person. That all, it's called, all that was to be done by me has been done. You know? There's no one home that wants to transmigrate. You know? There's yourself, just yourself, your being, which is completely full. And the buddhi, really, which is pranamed to to the self. And so when this body dies, that ajnanam that really is the gasoline to fuel your next lives isn't there anymore. You're already, even while you're alive, loving just to be with the self and letting this world and everything this body does and all of that, let it just be Ishwara, you know. So you even look at all of your desires are Ishwara. I don't have that, say, you know, you said, I don't have that desire, and that desire isn't really my desire. I have that desire, but it's here, it's Bhagavan. That's when Swamiji got this aim for seva. You know, he's in his mid-60s or something, or a little older even. We're so shocked, you know, that he had this, they asked him to do this aim for seva. And before that time, he had no such desire. He was ready and retiring and was going to go out and live out his life at Rishikesh just as a simple sadhu, and then his students would come there. No, no, not even an inkling. Until these people came, you know, some of his students, older students, they had this great idea of, you know, all India movement for aim for seva, to try to help India and help the different tribes who are really suffering because so much conversion. And when they said it, Swamiji, to his great surprise, really wanted to do it, and he said yes. He did it. Everything that he thought he was going to be doing, he just tossed to the side more or less, and he just got totally involved in this. He kept teaching, but this took up a tremendous amount of time. It became a huge organization, and he happened to, you know. So he said, "I'm living a second life. This is the life I had had any idea. Bhagavan just, you know, threw it on my lap. And he was into it. That's fine. You know, but when he goes or when we go, if that maturity is there and I don't want to go be a tennis player or something, whatever it happens to be, you know, there's no vritti there to go anywhere or do anything, to be any other than just Ishvara. You know, because the self is so whole and complete and Ishvara is its natural expression. So because of that, there's no transmigration. All of the elements, the subtle elements, go back into the subtle elements. The physical elements go back to the physical elements. And there is no jiva. There's just Brahman. Brahman, which is Ishvara. Who you are. Who you are without being trapped inside a limited body. You're just the whole that is who you are. So there is no reincarnation or anything going on there. But if you've, say, gotten to a point with this knowledge and the time when you are, when you leave this body, if there's still some desires that need to be fulfilled that are there, then you'll take another body. What difference does it make? You'll always pick up the thread. Once you become a mumuksha, you always pick up the thread of where you left off. That's a promise, Krishna's promise in the Shastra. And you'll get, take care of those lingering desires, you know, binding desires, like I really want to do this. You'll take up those things, you'll get a good body. You'll either be born in the house of jnanis, or you'll be born and get from birth, or you'll meet your teacher along the way and pick up the thread in that way. And continue, work out these karmas that are important to you. You took a body for it, and so those will, you have another round. But it shouldn't matter at all because you've been, had infinite rounds, so what's one or two more? It really doesn't matter. I would never worry about that. If there's something unfinished, good, let's do it again then. It's not a problem. It's not a problem, really. It's not a problem at all. When you say that for a jnani, the buddhi can rest and be with the self, does that mean that the buddhi is quiet and just being with what is? If I understand it right, I recognize the shanti of myself and the mind is not in resistance to anything. No resistance to the outer inner world. When the mind has no resistance and is fairly quiet, is that what you mean by the buddhi resting with the self? Yeah, it's not that the buddhi has to have a samadhi vritti or something, it's not that the buddhi can't be engaged in the world, or but it has no problem with it. You're in harmony with Ishvara, and so it has no, there is no resistance. There's no really raga dvesha. There's non-binding desires, that's what keeps you going. But there's nothing, there's no emotional stress that is producing affect that is kind of in competition with your own being. Right, so your own being is has so much kind of shanti and your mind is really agitated. And so what is natural for you to do with an agitated mind is try to calm it down, either by fulfilling the desire or getting some distraction or pulling it back to your knowledge. You know, because that agitated or hurt or depressed or sad mind is not your nature. And so everything about you goes to heal that in one way or another. If you have knowledge, then you actually know how to really heal it, because you know where the ananda is, you know how to talk to the mind. You can bring it home, you can be with it in a way that is actually really meaningful. If you don't have self-knowledge, then you try to find something that is soothing, a person that can help you, that can soothe you, or a situation that can take off some of the pressure, you know, or make this or that change to try to get into a situation where you can kind of get away from that type of reaction. So that when we say a shanti, does not mean that everything has to stop. It's just that that quality of mind, that peace of mind, is not disturbed at all by what you're doing or how you're engaging in the world. And so there's a deep shanti, and you're going to be very busy. Swamiji is one of the busiest person people I've ever met in my life. Swamiji, somebody asked him, Swamiji, when do you rest? Because he has have such long days. He'd get up, you know, when he was older, he would get up, you know, 5:30 or 6, which was late for him. He used to always get up like around 4:30. Get up 5:30 or 6, somebody would bring him tea, and he's off for the rest of the day, like until 10, 11, 12 at night with one thing after another after another. Swamiji, when do you rest? I rest between my thoughts. Mm-hmm. It's a way of saying I'm always at rest. Yeah, I'm always at rest. So, I like that. The jiva, individual, is it the same as the sukshma sharira, or are there more aspects to the jiva? Okay. First of all, what makes a jiva is the self-ignorance, is the ajnanam. So that's the core of the jiva. If that ajnanam, if that ignorance is there, self-ignorance is there, then there's the ajnanam, there's the ahankara, there's the identification with the upadis, which is completely natural if that ajnanam is there. So if we say that ajnanam is there, now there's this body, mind, sense organs, then the full manifestation, you know, of this ajnanam is this, the stula sharira, the physical body, with the sukshma sharira, with the karana sharira. So the physical body, the subtle body, the causal body, all together, we can say that is the jiva in full form. But the core of the jiva is the self-ignorance that is the cause of the ahankara. You know, that's what it is. So, anything more to that? I'd say it's the core of the jiva is the ajnanam, which causes the ahankara, that I notion that is going to identify with whatever is there to be identified with. So the sukshma sharira it will identify with, all the different parts of the sukshma sharira, the physical body it will identify with. You know, because through the sense of touch, the mind uses the sense of touch going through the whole physical body as a sense of being conscious of the I am this, as a sense of me, right? Because of the subtle body, sense of touch. And then the mind and the sense organs are sattva, right? So that has a sense of me. So this whole upadi, that's why we call it upadi, it's an upadi. It's very easy for the ajnanam, ignorance born ahankara, to land on this. It makes sense. It's a beginningless mistake. But it's not anybody's mistake, it's just a natural condition, right? Of ajnanam. And it's only self-knowledge that can remove that, really. And you don't have the pramanas necessary to remove that. The best we can do is live a dharmic life and try to meditate all the time and sit in samadhi. That's what people do. But there's something more to know. We have to know that you are Ishwara. That's the Vedanta, actually. You are Ishwara. Because then there's nothing else. If you just say, I am Brahman, and you don't realize that the Maya Upadi has Brahman as its adhishtana, then there's a difference between Ishwara and Brahman. You know, and this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara, to the creation. And so unless I can resolve this body, mind, sense organs into Ishwara as belonging and being like a cell in the body of Ishwara, I have to do something here to make my way. But when I understand this whole thing as Ishwara, I can let Ishwara make my way. It's his way, really. There's no my way. Ishwara is my way. I am Ishwara. You know, this is part of Ishwara. So I'm either Ishwara This body, mind, sense organs belong to Ishwara and see what he does. Or myself. And from the standpoint of myself, as a Brahman, I am the very self of Ishwara. So there's a relaxation that takes place for Jnani where you like to see what comes next. Like what is Ishwara doing now? What's happening now? And you're included in that. This prarabdha karma is nothing but Ishwara. It's just the Ishwara that's surrounding you and that's unfolding. So you can just be present to it with some shraddha and that Ishwara arpana buddhi, you feel a certain love and devotion just for the way things are unfolding because it's Bhagavan. It's not that you're doing it. You're receiving it and responding. You're receiving and responding. I think I'm just going to do one more. We'll do the rest of those tomorrow. Can you repeat the difference between the five subtle and gross elements? Let me see. I'll do that one tomorrow. Because I can need a really easy one. That takes too much thought. Okay, this is hard too. I think I'm burnt out. I'm too tired tonight. That's okay. So don't let me not answer these. They're good questions. I don't want to answer them when I'm not able to. That's right. It's only 8:30. Okay, got you. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. We have other bhajan singers too. We can do two or three of them.
Janani. Janani.
Janani.
Janani.
Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani.
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 Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani.
Jaga Janani. Om Swasti Prajnavyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Marim Mahishah Go Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho yamsho bharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukha bhavet, asato ma satkamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritam gamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om